मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप
Chidananda Rupa
शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाह न च श्रोथ जिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योम भूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न मे द्वेषरागौ न मे लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मेऽन्नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासं ಜಗತಂ ನೈವ ಮುಕ್ತೇನ ಮೇಯ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ 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 ಶಿವೋಹಂ
Welcome, and from the depths of my heart and myself to the depths of yours, it's really great to be once again entering into this state we share. So this week with Grace, I'm going to try and take us through a string of sutras, including sutras 8 through 14, or maybe we'll even get to 16, which are devoted to the vision of what it is to be an advanced yogi, an accomplished one. The tradition calls these beings siddhas, fully enlightened beings, and the definition of siddha, which we're going to talk about today, is unique to the tantric traditions, both the Hindu-based tantric tradition and the Tibetan-based tantric tradition, because one of the hallmarks is the recognition that along with knowing yourself to be not simply the body or the mind, and the recognition that your own consciousness is divine consciousness, it also comes along with empowerment. Really insist is the ultimate goal of this practice. So I also just want to take a moment and allow us to focus on the translation of the last verse of the Nirvanashtakam, which we just listened to, which affirms the practice that's, or the understanding that's at the heart of all this. I am without thought, without form. I am all-pervasive. I am everywhere, yet I am beyond all senses. I am neither detachment, nor salvation, nor anything that could be measured. I am consciousness and bliss. I am Shiva. I am Shiva. And there's something about these verses they contain the realization of so many sages of the Advaita Vedanta tradition. And when we listen to it or when we read it, it somehow brings alive our connection to these sages. And some of these sages are some of you, because I think one of the things that we're all starting to realize as we practice with these admittedly very advanced yogic teachings is that we have heard them before. We've practiced them before, not just because you've taken some classes from me or other teachers who teach Trika Yoga, but because you've actually practiced with them in other lifetimes. They are part of your karmic being. And this in itself is something quite extraordinary to contemplate. So let's begin with our chants and our meditation. And then we'll come back to the Anava Upaya practices based on the secrets hidden in the body and breath, which, as you know, and as we've been discovering, are filled with unexpected doorways, portals into infinity that lurk in unexpected places. For instance, the hollow of your armpits, the base of your throat, the tip of your right big toe. And don't ask me why it's the right big toe rather than the left big toe, or the left big toe rather than the right big toe. The portals of the physical and subtle bodies are mysteries, but they're real. And in my experience, they're not just confined to these kind of official places. They're actually all over the body. You know, as in that famous painting of Alex Gray's, which some of you may have seen, it's kind of a psychedelic painting where he shows a field which is filled, a sky filled with eyes. So, you know, indicating that there is awake, alive consciousness in everything. And this is, of course, hardcore tantra. So find a posture. If you don't have your chanting sheet, this would be a good moment to get it. And as you take the posture, focus on the inhalation, the downward breath, allowing the breath to ground your body, to help you sink into the base, to activate the sits bones, and then allowing the exhalation to flow as a kind of deep letting go that arises from that grounded base up through the crown of the head. Allowing the breath, again, to flow in and down towards the base, upward with the exhalation to the crown. And I find it's very skillful and also relaxing to sway from one buttock to the other, just very slowly. And then to circle your hip bones as though you're circling around the coccyx, and let your body find that aligned point where you're actually seated in your own center, poised over the triangle formed by the pubic bone in front and the two sits bones behind, with your head directly over the center of the triangle, your shoulder blades clasped the back. Your face is soft. And we're going to begin by invoking the presence of Ganesha, the elephant-faced one who removes all obstacles, whom we always bow to at the beginning of our practice. And then we'll chant the Mahamrityunjaya Mantra, the invocation to Shiva as the great conqueror of death. We'll chant the Mahamrityunjaya three times, and then the Dakshinamurti Stotram, the invocation to Shiva as the Guru, and finally, the invocation to the primordial goddess. So, as we begin, take a moment to imagine the subtle form of Ganesha. He of huge body and crooked trunk, whose form is made of light as bright as billions of suns. O Ganesha, who is the repository of all forms of grace, be pleased to remove all obstacles from our practice. And we'll begin with the Mula Mantra, Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Two more times. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Imagine that as you recite these mantras, you're actually calling him, asking him to be present in the room. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. And one more time. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. And now the Dhyana Shloka, the four-line verse. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Inhale, exhale, inhale, and we'll invoke the worship of the Three-Eyed Lord, making the fragrant offerings of these mantras into the fire, the auspicious fire. Free us from the grip of death, just as the cucumber is severed from the vine. Do not keep us away from the nectar of immortality. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om. And now the invocation to Shiva as the guru of all the worlds, the physician who cures all worldly ills, to the one who is the ocean of all wisdom, the Lord who initiates us into the highest truth, which, by the way, is what he's doing during this class. Gurave sarvalokanam bisaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarvavidyanam dakshina murtaye namaha. And at last, to she who underlies every particle of our experience of life, who has become us, who is this world. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani namostute. Om. And as you freshen your posture, allow your awareness to spread out and become conscious of all of us joined together here in this community. This Sangham, which holds the amalgamation of each other's loving, most awake, most truly expansive qualities of being. And as we invoke these aspects of ourselves, of our individual selves, we're connecting with the soul of the universe who's living through each of us as that part of us which is utterly pure, completely free, and deeply in love with every particle of reality. So we're going to practice with the vertical breath, feeling that as the breath flows in, it flows as a stream of sparkling, shimmering, scintillating blue light that flows from a region high above your crown, a region that, even though it may be mysteriously hidden from your view, is actually the source of life, the place where the primordial consciousness and the primordial love are endlessly at play. Imagine, feel this blue light of absolute radiance flowing from the heart of the universe, from the heart of the goddess, flowing down through your crown, bathing your brain, flowing through your throat and into the region of your heart. Feel that the light fills the heart. And as the light pools inside your heart center, recognize that it is forming a lake of pure radiance that vibrates with unimaginable depth and extraordinary love and wisdom, and which is the true expression of your unclouded heart. Just let yourself be present with the radiance descending from above and pooling as blue light in your heart. Now let your attention gently float down to the base of the spine, to the area just in front of the coccyx. And this time inhale with the feeling that the deep breath is flowing up from inside the earth. And with the exhalation, a scarlet radiance rises up through the center of the body, flows into the heart, mingling with the blue lake of radiance. And take a few more breaths, inhaling earth light, scarlet earth light, from the earth into the Muladhara, and then exhaling that earth radiance up into the heart. And little by little, you allow the breath to come to rest in the heart. You allow yourself to be present to the mingled light of heaven and earth. And you find yourself aware that all of us are seated around the lake, seated in our subtle individual forms, as flames. We are in the subtle body of the radiant individual self, the Jivatma, in the form of a thumb-sized flame. We are both the individual souls who gaze at the lake. We're also the lake itself. Imagine now that the flame that is your individual self is placed upon the water. So along with all of us, you're floating inside that radiance of consciousness. And with great peace and great affection and a deepening focus in the heart, Let yourself be present as the awareness which holds the lake in the heart, the flames floating upon it. Which both recognizes the presence of all of us, and is able to hold each other in that radiant awareness. Meditate in the heart as the great lake of consciousness. As of course you know, we're working with these sutras not simply with the intention to increase our knowledge of tantric Sanskrit shlokas and sutras, but really in the service of understanding more deeply what it is to expand our individual consciousness into its source. And one of the most interesting pieces of lore, let's call it, that Trika offers us is the way that it reframes the traditional eight limbs of yoga as taught by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras. Kshema Raja, the commentator who's really given us most of the commentary that we use in interpreting the sutras of the Shiva Sutras, also of the Vijnana Bhairava, and who is also the author of the Recognition Sutras, which to many of us is kind of the core text of Shaiva Tantra that we use to understand the sweep of the tradition. Kshema Raja saw the eight limbs of Patanjali as being partial, mainly because they're exoteric. They have to do with the, let's call it, the external aspect of our practice, you know, in which we attempt to practice yogic disciplines like nonviolence and truth-telling as a way of making ourselves more, let's call it, fit for deeper states. You know, it talks about the seated posture, about the practice of withdrawing your attention from external awareness into the inner body, focus, etc. But Kshema Raja and the Tantras in general felt that to define yourself primarily as a practitioner, learning skills and training your mind to turn inside, is just the start. And Trika, being essentially an advanced course, Trika is not really for beginners, even though many of us have been studying this tradition ever since we were beginning yogis. I certainly am one of those. I started studying this when I was, you know, a mere egg in spiritual practice. But Trika prides itself on always starting in non-duality, beginning at the end, so to speak, because the end is the beginning. So even though Anava Upaya practices are considered to be the less advanced form of practice, it is certainly not a beginner's practice, and many of you have noticed this. These practices are actually quite difficult, technical. They demand focus. But what's more important is that the Anava Upaya practices rest on a non-dual frame. So if you were a traditional practitioner of the Shaiva, the non-dual Shaiva Tantra, the Trika Yoga system, you would have been steeped in the subtle philosophy of non-dual Tantra, in which you have heard from your guru again and again and learned the sutras again and again, which explain to you that your I, your consciousness, your interior self is Shiva, and that everything in your inner and outer experience is Shakti, is an expression of Goddess. So this is where you start as an Anava Upaya practitioner. And when you entered your meditation practice, it would be with the understanding that you are meditating not as a limited individual, but as consciousness itself, who has temporarily lost sight of its own vastness, but who is completely aware that this is what you are. So in Anava Upaya practice, even when you're struggling with concentration or interiorizing your attention, you never forget that you already are what you're looking for and that what you are is unreservedly divine. And that's, of course, the hardcore of pretty much all non-dual practice. And it's really not so different in that way from the teachings of Advaita Vedanta or Mahayana Buddhism. It's always said in those traditions that you should enter your sadhana with the understanding that the goal, what we call the self, the Atman, and what Buddhists call the original mind, is already you. It's, in the words of the great Vedantic sages, the goal is already attained. You're already that. And if you weren't already that, you wouldn't be here, you wouldn't be alive, because it's only the existence of consciousness, of the self, whose nature is self-illuminating radiance, that allows anything to exist. And if you've been studying non-dual teachings through your life, as I know some of you have studied with a lot of non-dual teachings, this is kind of the bottom line. And it's something that we often take for granted. I know I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit, when I hear this teaching from another teacher, or when I write it in an article, or when I say it in a talk, I'm often tempted to kind of take for granted what this means. But it's actually a very big deal, because it's incredibly important to practice sadhana from the perspective of understanding that you are in the deepest sense okay, that there's nothing you need to do to become more worthy of what you already are, and that even at your craziest, even at your most unhappy, even as your most scatterbrained, you are still Shiva Shakti in this form, which means that you're lovable and worthy on a level that most of us only occasionally recognize. So Trika takes this understanding, which again, is the core of most of the non-dual traditions. It takes this understanding several steps further and tells us that there is nothing anywhere that's not worthy of active worship, because there's nothing anywhere that's not an expression of love-saturated Shakti, who is freedom and bliss, and who is pulsing in every particle of the universe. So you do sadhana in order to know that, and for that you need her active help. But you already are that, and your entire life is her dance. So for me, the really most profound gift that Trika Sadhana gives us is this kind of dual understanding that Shakti is doing everything so we can relax and surrender and let whatever is happening happen, because it really is okay. It really is what we need to experience in our journey. And that includes anxiety and hard work and whatever's going on with your relatives. So we always want to have this profound intention to surrender to what is. And yet at the same time, we want to also have the intention to recognize that at the deepest level, we are ourselves the controller of it. So in other words, our life is not being done to us. Our life is being lived by us, not in our limited self form, but in our most expanded form as the ultimate subject, Shiva. You know, again, as we know, the secret behind all the great Trika lineages is an utter reliance on Shakti and Kundalini, and the recognition that this vibrant, extraordinary force, which has brought us to the place we are now, also intends to reveal what she is and will, without doubt. You know, as we've said before, the method of self-knowledge, of self-knowing that works for you, will depend on the intensity of the descent of Shakti into your system. And one of the things that I've discovered over the years, you know, over my many years of practice of expansion and contraction, moving through the spiral of awakening and falling back asleep and awakening again, our Shakti, our ability to hold Shakti, and our ability to be truly moved by Shakti changes. It varies according to our health, according to how busy we are or how distracted, according to what's going on in our relationships, and all sorts of mysterious factors related to karma. Because our level of Shakti is always going to be different, the practices that work for you today may be different than the practices that work for you tomorrow. You know, if you're in a highly active Shakti state, you can be catapulted through grace into the experiences described in Book One, where you actually experience an immediate aha recognition that your own awareness is God's awareness, and that as such you are the source of everything. And, you know, in these high Shakti states, this is not an intellectual recognition. It's a radical expansion of awareness where it really is true for you. In the middle level, when your Shakti is not that strong, but is still pretty strong, you approach this experience of yourself as consciousness through the energies of imagination, language, mantra, with the recognition that your mind is Shakti and that your thoughts and feelings are arising in the ocean of Shakti that is your mind. And you learn how to, over and over again, dissolve the limiting thoughts and feelings into the Shakti of an empowered mantra, or by diving directly into the energy of your citta, and allowing it or coaxing it or simply allowing the deepening of your meditation practice to expand your citta until it reveals itself as deeper and deeper layers of undulating awareness. And in Anava Upaya practice, it's all about opening the gateways in the breath and the subtle body centers. And as we've been practicing last week, noticing regions of the physical body as focal points that open up into expanded awareness. And the practice of meditating on the elemental points in the physical body, or the practice of letting the elemental aspects of yourself dissolve in laya bhavana or the kalagni rudra practice of letting your body catch on fire and dissolve into consciousness. These are important sthika practices. But I also want to say that they're not the core Anava Upaya practices. Because the core Anava Upaya meditation practices is meditation on the center, on the central channel, supported by breathing processes like the process we've been doing in our core meditation practice, by cleansing practices like Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing, and also by meditation on the spaces that are the source and the end point of every breath you take. And those of you who've studied with me for a while will have done these practices with me many times, and I'm certainly not the only tantric teacher who teaches them. But we're going to be playing with some of them today, and I want to kind of flag the importance of this space that's called the madhya, the middle space, the center, which I often equate with T.S. Eliot's great poetic statement in the Four Quartets, the still point of the turning world, neither place nor placeless, neither from nor towards. There the dance is, and there is only the dance. He somehow got the madhya. And I think those lines encapsulate it as well as anything I've ever read or heard. So this practice that we've been doing and that we're going to continue doing of breathing the mantra into the three centers is one of the methods of opening the central channel in the inner body, the Sushumna Nadi, which, as many of you know, is actually a thread of pure prana that lies between the two ordinary breaths, the two ordinary channels, the nadis through which our in and out breath moves. We're practicing with the central channel, which I'm going to call the Madhya Nadi for the duration of this class. And when we say Madhya Nadi, you know, Madhya Nadi means middle channel. But in esoteric terms, it means something much bigger. It means the channel where consciousness expands to reveal its source, to reveal that the source of everything, the source of your life, the source of your mind, the source of your beauty, that all of it is there present, hidden in this space that opens up between an ordinary inhalation and an ordinary exhalation, and which wants to expand. So this practice and the practice of meditating on the beginning and end of the breath, the space at the beginning and end of the breath, which I know many of you have done, maybe even as a core practice for years, are not just centering techniques. They're not just meditation techniques. They're actually meant to plunge you into the inside of the inside, the breath within the breath, and show you this really amazing thing, which is that what is keeping you alive is not the oxygen that you take in with the air, but this life source, this deep stillness, where Shakti manifests as the formless, blissful source of your ordinary experience of breathing. So, as I know some of you have experienced and some of you experience a lot, and those of you who haven't experienced it, I guarantee you that you will, that when the Sushumna opens, or the space between the inhalation and exhalation opens, the breath stops moving in and out through the nostrils. And you enter a state where it feels as if you have expanded from within. It's a kind of field ground reversal where the boundaries of your body, the borders of your body, kind of implode in on themselves, and you begin to experience the fact that your real body is this expanse of consciousness. It's very hard to describe, and it seems opaque until you have your first experience of it, but it really can feel like your normal consciousness kind of opens like a trapdoor and becomes the platform, the asana of your deepening meditation, literally the inner seat where you take rest. And this experience, this recognition, is actually the core of Trika Yoga, which we'll talk about a little bit more later on. But when the Trika yogis, when the Trika sages talk about asana, this is one of the later Shiva Sutras, they're not talking about the physical posture. They're talking about being seated in the heart, being seated in the madhya, being seated in the central channel. And that the seat, the yogi's true seat, is the open space of the madhya. And from that seat, you know, those of you who have studied the Recognition Sutras will be familiar with this, the process of realization, according to Trika Yoga, is simply the expansion of that subtle presence, which is our true interior. You start by coaxing it forward, so to speak, and again, language of directionality is not really, cannot really describe it, but you start by focusing, by coaxing it forward, by concentrating on the beginning and end of each breath, or by letting the internal breath flow between the muladhara and the heart and the crown. And if you can stay in meditation for a while and keep allowing that spaciousness to reveal itself and keep returning to it every day, that this inner sphere literally unfolds. That's the word that the texts use. It unfolds the way a bud unfolds. You know, the way the embryo unfolds from its, you know, curvy comma shape and becomes a full human baby. It might seem opaque and like no big deal and like something that you have to focus on to stay present with. But as you keep focusing again and again, it starts to show you its depths. So, what happens in Trika meditation, whether we're meditating on Laya, as we've been doing in the last couple of weeks, or meditating on the central channel, or meditating on the space between the breaths, there's always a moment when your ordinary awareness dissolves and you find yourself, again, this is the core of it, you find yourself being breathed by the invisible current of prana shakti, which doesn't move through the nostrils. but which is actually the truth of what keeps us alive. So with that in mind, we're going to do a very brief practice of Ujjayi pranayama, which is a form of central channel breathing that flows, that starts in the heart and goes up to the sahasrara, to the crown. Ujjayi can be a very complex practice involving holding the breath and visualizing a flame, but we're going to do it in a very simple way right now. So, and we're going to do it just for a couple of minutes. We'll keep returning to it in the course of this evening's practice. But I want us to, you know, kind of get into the flow of it. Your inhalation is flowing in from the space 8 finger widths above the crown, which is called the upper Dwadashanta, the upper space of 12. 12 being the measurement of 12 fingers above the 6th chakra, but I like to measure it as 8 fingers above the crown, because it's just easier to do. So those of you who like to use your physical body as a focal point, just measure 8 fingers from your fontanelle by placing the side of your right forefinger against the crown, and then the side of your left forefinger next to your pinky, and then stabbing with a free finger at the place at the top of that 8-fingered space. Extraordinarily, I mean, it always blows my mind when I find out that by bringing my attention there, there's a big expansion of Shakti. So that's the upper Dwadashanta. The lower Dwadashanta is behind the breastbone. It's that space that we call the heart center, the heart chakra. And with your eyes closed and your posture upright, it's possible to do this lying down, but it's stronger if you're seated upright. Begin to inhale through the crown, allowing the breath to flow in without too much effort, but with quite a lot of focus, down through the crown and into the heart. And when the breath, when the inhalation is done, focus for just a couple of seconds on the pause at the end of the inhalation. And then let the exhalation naturally arise. Don't strain. Don't try to hold your breath. Just note the pause, the gap. And let the exhalation rise from the heart up through the center of the throat, up through the head, into the space 8 fingers above the crown, the upper Dwadashanta. And then allow yourself to linger for a couple of seconds in that pause. Your focus is not so much on the flow of the breath as on these two spaces, the upper space and the space behind the breastbone. These are the doorways into the madhya. And this is the core practice of the Vijnana Bhairava, described in the famous verse 24, which is the first practice that Shiva gives Parvati when he's trying to explain to her how to enter the state of the self. Inhaling, exhaling, letting your focus linger in the pause, the gap. Travel between the upper Dwadashanta and the lower Dwadashanta, between the upper heart and the lower heart. And if the breath wants to continue moving or your attention is in one of these spaces, don't try to bring yourself out of it. Just let yourself be there. We're going to talk about several of what I consider extremely esoteric sutras. And, you know, as we read these sutras, for some of us, they might feel kind of abstract and like they're describing something that is a little bit out of reach. So I want to just say where I'm coming from as I enter these, you know, really quite extraordinary, let's say shout out to the most exalted stage of human consciousness. And the reason that I feel intimate with these sutras and these states, even though I'm certainly not in them, is because of the influence of my guru, Swami Muktananda, who I lived with from 1974 until his passing in 1982. Muktananda, if to everyone who knew him, and there are some people on this call who knew him, literally incarnated the realization that the text describes. And he taught this text as an expression of his own experience. You know, Muktananda, as many of you know, started his spiritual life as a traditional Vedantin sannyasi. In India, swamis tend to study and teach basic Advaita Vedanta, which is a radical non-dual teaching, very high teaching, in which the pith teaching is the absolute is real, the world is unreal, and the individual soul is the absolute, which is kind of the core of it. It's an approach to non-duality which is totally true as far as it goes, but it leaves out the role of Shakti, and it downgrades her creative activity by calling it the illusion brought about by the trickster Maya. So, you know, as many of you know, Advaita Vedanta is a little bit world-denying, and even though probably it doesn't mean to be, and is famous for being a renunciate's philosophy. So Muktananda, who did 25 years of really hardcore yogic sadhana before meeting his guru in his 40s, and receiving the Shakti download that permanently transformed his vision, awakened his Kundalini, showed him the truth, and then put him through a process of purification that is much more radical than anything you or I experience, even in our most intense moments of Kundalini purification. And after his enlightenment, which took another 9 years of deep meditation, after his enlightenment, he came across the Shaiva Tantra teachings, and he realized that this was the only philosophical system that fully explained his experience, because it's the only system of non-dual philosophy that totally recognizes the divine nature of Kundalini Shakti. And he would say that not only, you know, he loved this tradition, not only because the sages of Trika were Shaktas, they were goddess worshippers, and they worshipped goddess as the inner Kundalini, as he did, but also because the practices of Trika are so inclusive that they make space for everyone. So when he spoke from the Shiva Sutras and the Pratyabhigna Hridayam, he spoke with the authority of direct experience of their truth. And he kind of drilled this recognition, not as an intellectual understanding, but as kind of the core of my view of the world. He drilled it into me. And the sutras that we're going to talk about, along with several others, describe what he personally had realized. And frankly, the reason I believe the sutras is because of what it was like being around him. I mean, I must admit that if I hadn't known him, if I hadn't lived with him for such a long time and seen him in action and experienced countless transmissions from him, I might be much more skeptical about this core Trika idea that you can realize your own oneness with God in a human body. And he often would explain this to us by describing his own guru's state of consciousness. He didn't claim the state for himself. You know, like most highly accomplished yogis, he claimed nothing. And he left it to our experience to recognize who he was, which not everybody did, obviously. But when he spoke about his guru's state, he would get rhapsodic. And he loved to talk about the state of the Siddha, the accomplished being described in the Shaiva Tantra. And because we had him sitting in front of us, because we would become used to entering exalted states just by being in the room with him, these descriptions didn't feel so far-fetched. And they were all descriptions of a state that we'll see as we enter the sutras is called natural samadhi or sahaja vidya. He made them seem attainable. And along with that, he gave us a series of ways of understanding our own consciousness that we could use to uplift ourselves in any moment. So, and of course, there are so many stories and statements that we can use as contemplative practice pointers, especially the stories of great beings. You know, there's a really good reason why so many traditions make the stories of their founders the essence of their teaching. They're, when we read about and think about and contemplate the experience of a Ramakrishna or a Buddha or Jesus, we actually get, we kind of draw them into our consciousness. So I want to expand my consciousness and make you the offering of some of these words from Shankaracharya. My mind, like a hailstone, has melted into the ocean of bliss. Ramakrishna's description of a moment when he looked at the pile of garbage that was being picked over by the temple dogs, saw the light of the Divine Mother shining in them, and began to eat the garbage, feeling that he was offering himself divine prasad. Or the life of the Siddhas, Japruana, there's a few garbage stories here, who sat all day in a pile of garbage and always smelled like flowers. And this is what Swami Muktananda says about this in one of the chapters of his autobiography. When through the grace of the Guru, Kundalini rises in the central channel, one obtains the knowledge of the goddess Chitti, consciousness herself. Through meditation, his mind remains in the state of equanimity and perfect knowledge of Shakti arises from within. Such a yogi becomes totally serene in his meditation, and in his worldly life, he becomes totally free from anxiety. Chitti Shakti, of her own accord, assumes this state within the yogi. It's called Sahaja Vashta, or the state of pure, spontaneous realization. Such a person can see the blossoming of Shakti, of Chitti, in all the deeds and activities of his daily life, in his practice, in his house, in his children, and in everything he eats and drinks. In this unchangeable state, endowed with the force of the great mantra, Aham, I am, he loses the feeling that his body, his prana, his senses, and their objects are different from his own self. To him, they're all pervaded by chitti. He's inspired with the feeling that however he may conceive of them, it is the great and glorious Chitti Shakti who is the basis of them all. I could go on with this. Gets me really high. And one of the reasons it does is because when we read and contemplate such a statement, we're doing an actual Shakta Upaya practice, using words and imagination to contemplate the pure states. This is not the same as having a direct experience, but it's a great way of keeping your mind exalted. And this is probably at least one of the reasons why the Anava Upaya Sutras spend so much time describing the state of a liberated person. You know, the Anava Upaya path is the path that targets the experience of the individual. But what's really interesting about it, that in Book 3, there are only a couple of sutras devoted to the ordinary state of awareness. Unlike the Yoga Sutras or the Buddhist texts, which devote a lot of time to defining bondage and to describing the step-by-step path out of it, Shaivism is much more interested in showing you what it's like once you recognize that your personhood is a contracted version of Shiva's. So they expressed Abhinavagupta and Kshemaraja, as well as these sutras, were particularly interested in expressing the vision that arises when you step across the borders of Maya. So by Sutta 8, essentially what we're talking about is what it's like to be in the state of Sahaja Vidya and what you do when you slip out of it. It's, first of all, it's described as a state beyond the mind, and Muktananda was once asked to describe the state he's in. He said, "In the state that I'm always in, I go beyond the mind and senses and swim in the ocean of bliss." And then he said, "Sometimes I come out of it, but I know how to get back." It's the Anava Upaya practices basically that get you back. And I want to ask you that as you listen to these sutras, which are pretty darn high, it's really important not to feel that they're something that happens to somebody else. You know, as you know, we don't want to feel that we're so caught in striving to achieve an exalted state that somehow out of our reach, that we become what the Buddhists describe, that we, you know, enter what the Buddhists describe as seeking mind. And at the same time, we don't want to get complacent about our current experience and stop aspiring. So that, you know, the Buddhists correctly point out that trying to achieve an awakened state as if you weren't already awake is a huge spiritual obstacle. It's called the delusion of seeking. So we don't want to take the descriptions of great being state as something to admire from afar, because we always want to realize that we are already divine beings, and that what these sutras are describing is something that will be our experience sooner or later. I'm really serious. This is something that is coming to us, or coming for us, if you will. So let's, as we enter into the practice, let's begin for a moment to touch into the core recognition that we're, let's say, starting with. And we're going to do it through this vertical Uchchata practice. Firm your posture. Let the breath settle into the heart for a second or two. And begin to allow the breath to flow in through the crown, from the space 8 finger widths above the crown into the space of the heart. And as you do, as the breath flows in this vertical pathway, let yourself focus on the space at the beginning and the end of the inhalation and of the exhalation. You may notice that one of these spaces feels more comfortable for you. So in this moment, let yourself linger either in the space above the crown or the space in the center of the heart. And even though the breath is rising and falling, you hold your attention there and you ask yourself this fundamental inquiry practice. What is it that knows I'm breathing? And use that question as a prompt to recognize the awareness that is actually holding your whole experience, even as the breath flows from the crown to the heart. As you ask the question, there will be a moment of aha, a moment when awareness notices itself, might last for a fraction of a second. And this practice which combines the awareness of the Shakti space, the central channel, the Madhya, with the Jnana Yoga practice of asking who is it that knows my experience, you're actually doing a preliminary joining of the Shiva and Shakti aspects of yourself. And as this awareness that we're cultivating expands, you have seated yourself in the asana, the fundamental asana of Trika Yoga. So in this state, which we enter Sutra 8, which describes the state of the awakened yogi, the Sanskrit is Ajagrat Dvitiya Karaha, one who is always awake, who lives in the state beyond the mind, and in whom the world appears as the effulgence of his own light. One who is always awake, and that means by always awake, as the sutras will continue to describe, means that you are actually lucidly aware. This is a really high state, not only during waking life, also in dreams, and at the most radical development of this state of Sahaja Vidya, you experience that luminous awakeness even in the midst of deep sleep, which in this text actually describes not just what happens when we close our eyes in bed, but also the state of what we call nirvikalpa samadhi, where the meditator is plunged into a kind of a void where there's no thought, no breath, but awareness remains awake. So in Sahaja Vidya, you no longer have to work for indrawn consciousness. You don't even have to think about it because it is your daily experience. The poet Kabir wrote a song called Sahaja Samadhi, natural absorption, in which one of the lines is, my fingers no longer move on the japa mala. I no longer sit for meditation. With my open eyes, I see God. So just hold this idea for a minute? In this state, your ordinary perception no longer sees distinction. What does that mean? What would that be like? What the sutra then says and goes on to say is that once you've entered that state of sahaja, it's like the veil has come off the world so that you're able to see the Chidananda in every moment. And the result of having that vision is that your experience of life, moment to moment, is that you're not identified at all with the personality and certainly not with the body. Instead, your experience is that you're playing the role of your empirical self, like an actor. And the next sutra, Sutra 9, is one of the most quoted aphorisms in the text. And it goes, Narshaka Atma, the self is the actor, the self is the dancer. In Sanskrit, the word Nartaka refers to the performer who dances in classical Indian dramas or in Bharatanatyam, the classical Indian dance. And the sutra has a double meaning because as an awakened individual, you realize that you're not the person you see in the mirror. And many of you have this experience. Many of you can actually kindle this experience in yourself. It's a kind of a good thing to do, looking in the mirror. It's one of my favorite things to do when I'm brushing my teeth, is to look at my eyes in the mirror and recognize that the consciousness that's looking at my reflection and also looking through my eyes is not my senses, it's not my mind. That awareness is much, much bigger, and I can often just see my body and see my mind as though I was that consciousness, as though I am that consciousness, aware of my individual self. It's a very accessible way to kindle the recognition of consciousness. And of course, it's the truth. So this is the first level of understanding this sutra, because it tells you that as an individual living in a subtle and causal body, as a jiva, that is, and remember in this book of the Shiva Sutras, Atma refers not to the great self, but to the individual experience of the self. So that individual self, sometimes called the soul, remember, migrates through different lifetimes, entering different physical bodies according to your karma and playing many, many different roles, including the roles you play in this lifetime. It's, on that level, this sutra recognizes that great soliloquy from The Winter's Tale, where Jacques says, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their entrances and their exits, and each man in his life plays many roles. This is part of what Shiva is saying, but whereas Shakespeare is talking about the individual who appears as your karmic persona, the sutra is also saying that the one who's playing the role of you is God, is Shiva. The real dancer, the real actor, is the great self hiding behind the costume of your personal experience. So, again, if you're familiar with Indian philosophy and mythology, you know that the core metaphor about how this world arises is that whatever goes on in this cosmos is a play, it's a dance, it's a lila. Shakti, in her role as Maya, writes the play, manifests the sets and the costumes, But the true actor, the one who's the source of the play, is Shiva. So, as my guru used to say, this world is God's blissful play, his drama, picnic, and sport, which is really a helpful thing to remember when you're having a bad day. And it's a crucial idea of Tantra, in Tantra, and it's often misunderstood. It's important to approach it understanding that at the level of day-to-day reality, it's important to take responsibility for yourself. But it's also very significant, and it's the way Shaivism deals with the problem of evil, which is so important in Western religion. You know, that Shaivism deals with the problem of evil by saying that this world is a drama and conflict and suffering are part of the play. As Abhinavagupta says in several places, if there wasn't conflict, if there weren't villains, you wouldn't have the drama. And basically his position is that it wouldn't be fun, it wouldn't be art. You know, and I realize that this is essentially an aesthetic vision of the world rather than a moral vision. It's certainly the exact opposite of the Judeo-Christian idea about the world, which really sees it as a play of forces of good and evil. To the Shaivites, it's all the drama, this entangled tapestry of interdependent acts and relationships. And again, other Eastern systems like Buddhism and Taoism want you to detach yourself from the play, to renounce the play, to stand aside from it. But for the Shaiva yogis, like Abhinavagupta, the idea is that if you can recognize your life as a drama being danced by the divine self, then you could ride the roller coaster of your particular karmic drama with all its ups and downs, not to mention the horror show of human cruelty and the beauty of human love. You can ride this drama, you can enact your part in this drama without getting caught in identifying with it. And this is really something that I've aspired to for many years. And I've come to realize that seeing it all as the play doesn't mean that you don't feel and that you don't care. It's much more than taking the long view, the cyclical view of history. It's actually being able to maintain love and equanimity in the midst of the horror as well as in the midst of the ecstasy, and this is one of the things we learn from great beings. My guru was very, very emotionally expressive. You know, he would yell at you, he would weep, he would laugh his head off when something silly happened, he would play dumb practical jokes and literally explode in laughter. But none of his emotions lasted more than a few minutes. They literally played through him. This is true of many of the great beings. There's a story that I've always loved, which many of you might identify with, which is about Ramakrishna, the great sage, who introduced so many of us to the kind of radical path of non-dual devotion. He was unbelievably emotional, and he would burst into tears, he would dance in ecstasy, he would sometimes behave in a way that made people think he was crazy. And later in his life, he became incredibly attached to two of his young disciples, one of whom was the future Swami Vivekananda, who brought Vedanta to the West. And when they came to, you know, when they didn't visit him, he would weep and call for them and beg the other people around to bring Narendra, which was Vivekananda's name, to him. And one of his old devotees once scolded him for being so attached. He said, you know, if you go on being so attached to that boy, you're going to be reborn. And Ramakrishna said, you know, the reason I love him is because I see the goddess dancing in his form. If I ever stopped seeing the goddess in him, I'd never look at him again. So this really is the fallout of this state of recognizing that it's the self, it's Shiva, it's Shakti, who's dancing. And if you can look at your inner world, in fact, I'm going to ask you to do that for just a moment. is close your eyes. We're just going to do it with the inner world, though you're very welcome to apply this understanding to your whole life. But just look at what's arising. Maybe there's stillness, maybe there's discomfort, maybe there's joy, maybe there are different thoughts marching across your citta. So look into your own mind, your own consciousness, your own inner world, with the recognition, Shakti is dancing as my mind. All these thoughts, all these feelings, the crick in my back, the feeling of my breath, the slight headache, the swelling in the heart, all of these are part of the dance of Shakti. Wherever your mind goes, wherever your body goes, whatever your senses see, is the dance of Shakti, the dance of the self. Nartika Atma, the self is the dancer. The self is the actor. Not the body. Not the mind. These are just the effect, the costumes. It's her. Who's dancing this dance? She's dancing as your personal self. Sutra 10 continues the metaphor. It says, Rango Nataratma. Sorry, I have a hard time pronouncing that. Rango Nataratma. Actually, the Sanskrit is Rango Antaratma. But the A gets kind of eaten up by the O in Rango. And what it means is the inner self is the stage. And by inner self here, it means the personal inner self, antaratma. I love the way that the same Sanskrit words can be used to mean individuality and vastness. The word atma is one of the really, really great words in Sanskrit and in Indian philosophy. So the inner self, your personal individual self, is the stage. Your subtle body and your causal body are the platform, the arena on which Shiva plays, on which Shakti plays. So it's a really interesting way of looking at your inner experience. The mind and the thoughts in the mind have nothing to do with you. And the citta, you know, this platform for the play of thought and emotion, and the physical body, are simply the the field upon which the drama of your individual karma plays out. And it plays out, this is an image from one of the core Shaiva texts, the Spandakarikas, in which it's said that Shakti performs this play of your life as entertainment for the great witness, the pure subject Shiva, her consort, her beloved, her lord. She's doing this display of your thoughts, of your body, of all the ups and downs of your life and of the physical world as entertainment for the unmoved witness who lives as your I am. So everything that you think of as mine, including your activities, your feelings, your states, are not yours. They're being done by Shakti, who is the dancer, the actress. And they're all taking place on this stage that she's created in order for the play to happen. It's a very, very far out understanding that can be very liberating if you start to practice with it. So remember, the subtle body includes your pranas, all the energies that give life to your body, your strength, your shakti, your personal shakti. It also includes your mind, your intellect, your ego, which come into being out of the void state known as the causal body, which holds the blueprint of our karma. So all of these experiences are staged on the subtle and causal bodies, and of course the physical body as well. The knower, the witness, the awake light of the self is the ever-present consciousness that we experience in a kind of a limited way in daily life, but which in meditation actually rises from the space opened by the madhya, opened inside the madhya, and shows you that that which lives through your body-mind is the radiant light of awareness. So, to recognize that this consciousness, or as Adyashanti likes to say, your garden variety awareness, is a limited version of Shiva's living presence, it's really your goal as a yogi to begin to identify with this awareness so that you can start to recognize that your mind and ego and prana are actually the platform through which the particular drama of your karmic existence is being played out, which means that you can let this play happen, of course making appropriate decisions and activities, actions, but without feeling that it's you who's doing it. And frankly, I find this the most liberating awareness that it's possible to experience. So let's go back into the Uchara practice. Take care of selves. Into the breath and begin to allow the radiance of the breath to flow from the crown down into the heart. To pause for a fraction of a second to flow up to the space above the crown, to pause there. And as you poise yourself in that spaciousness, sit see if you can allow that space of consciousness to pulsate as blissful Shakti, and also to connect you to the knower, the witness consciousness who is present to the flow of the breath. Sutra 11 says, Prekshakani Indriyani. It rhymes. Prekshakani Indriyani. The senses are the spectators of the play. And this means both the externally focused senses that see the external world, which actually is not external at all, as we'll see later in the Shiva Sutras, but is actually the expression of your inner consciousness. But the senses are the spectators of the play of reality as Shiva's dance. The senses are the audience. So Shakti performs the dance of your life and also performs the dance of the world. And through your senses, both your externally focused eyes and ears and sense of touch, and the internally focused senses, which you experience when you turn into your inner world, the senses are the audience. And we could say that Shiva is able to witness the play through the senses. They've witnessed both the interior dance of thought and emotion and the external experience. And again, you have to remember that the Shaiva Tantrika sages were great aesthetes. They really enjoyed experiencing the world as a dance. So when you're aware that there actually is no individual me separate from the play, which in this mind-blowing teaching is being enacted on the stage of your inner experience of your body-mind by Shiva himself, and in which your senses are acting as the witness, allowing Shiva to enjoy all this through you. And I want to say that the perception of this state, because in the experience of enlightened yogi, the senses have really changed their way of revealing reality. Rather than showing you the world outside yourself, and we're talking here about the enlightened yogi, the awake yogi, your very senses are showing you the room and the city and whatever is appearing on the TV screen as part of yourself. You have the actual waking state experience that all this is arising and subsiding inside yourself. So close your eyes again and begin to allow the breath to flow in from above down to the heart and flow from the heart up to the crown. And I want to speak for a minute about Sutra 12. I have to admit that I am kind of blasted by this conversation. In other words, my awareness is very expanded. And if yours is expanded, I want to ask you to actually bring your awareness fully into the body. Perhaps bring your attention into the belly center or down to your feet. Because we're going to be talking in the next couple of minutes about Sutra 12, which is one of the core recognitions about how it is that self-realization happens. It reminds us that realization is not the result of the practice. It's the natural recognition that consciousness experiences of itself. Because when we turn inside, when we plant our flag in the madhya, when we take our seat on the inner platform of consciousness, what we discover is that consciousness itself is able to see through the illusion of separation and the illusion of being our bodies and our thoughts and recognize itself. So the sutra says, divashat sattva siddhihi. Divashat sattva siddhihi. I like this sutra a lot and I sometimes recite it. Divashat sattva siddhihi. Siddhi, of course, means achievement or realization. Sattva means pure, meaning the highest. And in this state, it's not talking about sattva guna. It's actually talking about the purest, subtlest aspect of your own citta. The first syllable, di, is one of the words in the Sanskrit language for intellect. So the divashat is the highest form of your intellect. That is the pure awareness that's the subtlest part of your citta. It's the most undiluted aspect of the citta. It's the experience where the mind begins to dissolve into its source and where the light of the self is discerned by itself. In other words, what sees the truth is your own consciousness seeing itself. It occurs as a natural consequence of the purified citta sinking back into its own self, into its own source. This happens in deep meditation. To an awakened yogi, it goes on in the waking state, which is pretty far out. In other words, as your ordinary mind is purified through practice and begins to be able to recognize itself as the field of shakti, when chitta starts to realize that within the thoughts, behind the thoughts, is pure consciousness manifesting as thoughts. You begin to be able to rest in the suchness of your undiluted mind field, the field of your own awareness. And what happens then is that your illumined mind reveals itself as prajna, which literally means insight or intuition. The mind in this state is called ritambara prajna, truth-bearing insight. So prajna is this natural arising of understanding of how things really are. And by the way, this kind of insight is not just the high state that you discover in meditation. It's a very, very natural. Your prajna, as many of you know, is the intuitive faculty that lets you discern what is true, what is real, what is appropriate in any situation. So, you know, it's that inner faculty that gives you the natural understanding of what you should say in a dicey situation. It's your inner GPS. It's your internal guidance system, which is, again, it's the deepest, or let's say it's the wisdom, it's the natural wisdom that consciousness has, which we block because of our thought stream and our emotional issues and our conditioned understanding. But if we can let it just reveal itself, it will guide us in every moment of life. And, you know, in fact, one of the ways that I've found that I can recognize my own progress as a meditator and as a, you know, as a human being, is that I don't agonize over decisions in the way I once did, because I've learned to recognize, and I know this is true for many of you, an innate knowing that just gets what's to do, what is real, what the truth is, even when my mind is going, but what about this and what about that? There's the prajna knows it. And, you know, when the prajna makes a decision, or when the prajna guides you, it's not through the intellect, the ordinary intellect, and it's not through the mind. So, you know, if you think back to a time when you met someone you felt drawn to, attracted to, and something said, don't get involved with this person. Maybe you paid attention to it, maybe you didn't, I often don't. But ultimately you discover, that was my prajna warning me that this person may not be good for me, or this thing that I'm about to, this, you know, job I'm about to take, or this party I'm about to go to, it's not actually the right thing for me. Your prajna knows. You know, and in those moments, those crazy moments when, you know, which I hear about from a number of people, you know, you walk into a room, you see another person across the room, and something says to you, I'm going to marry that person. And in many cases, it turns out to be true. This is your prajna. And when you're fully in touch with it, none of these intuitive decisions are mistaken. Even though things may not always turn out the way you expected, or sometimes the way you wanted. But as your meditation deepens, your innate intuition, your ritambara prajna, begins to operate to show you how to discern the self in the midst of thoughts. And it actually becomes the way in which enlightenment realization gets enacted, not only in meditation, but in the day-to-day. So the practice for cultivating this state is actually a Shakta Upaya practice, and it will be familiar to many of you, especially if you do meditation on consciousness in, you know, one of the direct path or Buddhist traditions. And the version of what we're going to do is it's kind of based on a Tibetan practice from the Vajrayana tradition. It's a practice for looking through the different phases of the mind, through the germ of awakened consciousness, the knower, which is always present. This is a practice called Mahamudra, or it's a form of Mahamudra practice. And there are many, many different ways to do this, but this one is particularly interesting. So close your eyes. And once again, just be present with the breath. And see if you can become aware of the play of thoughts and sensations, feelings, doubts, just simple movements of mind energy that are going on in your field of awareness, your citta. Feel as though with your inner senses, your inner eyes, you're looking into the field of the mind. This is a very subtle practice, but just in trying to do it, in making the attempt to do it, your citta, your subtle prajna, starts to recognize itself. So when I say watch the mind or regard the mind, I kind of mean look into the field that you see with your eyes closed. And imagine that your attention actually enters the field as though your attention is moving into the space that you might ordinarily conceive of as being in front of your body. And notice that you are actually regarding a kind of undulating field of energy that's full of, you know, little fragments, little particles of light and color. And as you internally gaze into that field, you might notice that there are several things going on in your own consciousness. There's a part of this field that is still, that's not doing anything. There's a part of it that's forming thoughts, and part of it that's kind of moving around as a kind of visual field. Just notice everything that's going on in this field in front of your mind. Don't think about it. The thoughts are actually part of what you're looking at. And then notice the part of the citta, the part of the mind field that is aware of this, that cognizes this, that knows this. That's your prajna. That's your subtle discernment. That, of course, is subtle awareness. And that subtle awareness is Chitti Shakti herself, who is acting through the mind, dancing upon the stage of your inner body and watching herself through this subtle knowingness, this natural awareness of awareness. Let yourself be with that. Recognizing the stuff that's rising and subsiding. Recognizing the knower that allows you to experience this. Jiva Shat Sattva Siddhihi. Jiva Shat Sattva Siddhihi. Through the higher spiritual intelligence, there is the realization of the light of the self. This is the faculty that will show you the self in this moment and in the moments when your consciousness expands. In any inner realization, it's this prajna, this divashat, this pure discerning intelligence that shows you who you are. So as we bring this call to an end, I want to ask you to bring your attention, your self-sense, what Carlos Castaneda calls your assemblage point, into the heart, into the space behind the breastbone. And just let the breath arise and subside. See if you can come back into your body without leaving the sense of the presence. Of the pure discerning intelligence awareness. Recognize that this is the immediate form in which Shakti directly allows you to see yourself as you really are. Maybe in this moment, that consciousness is not recognizing itself as radiant light. But in this moment, your subtle awareness is fully present and very immediately discernible as you let awareness be aware of itself. Thank you so much for being here, for entering into this pool of consciousness where we all support each other's practice. Without bringing you out of meditation, I want to tell you that we're going to be having a Q&A on Sunday, this coming Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific time, adjusted for your time zone. And Deb will be sending an announcement along with the homework and, of course, the audio of tonight's class, which will be available tomorrow. Have a beautiful evening. See if you can, or morning, if you're in another part of the globe than I am. And see if you can spend just a few minutes in meditation after we hang up the call. As we complete, you'll be hearing, of course, the Nirvanashtakam, the beautiful verses to remind us of our true nature. So much love to all of you. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां नचासंगतम नैव मुक्तिर्नमेय चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं।